It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to talk about the art of writing obituaries. And I want to start by reading one that caught a lot of people's attention. This appeared in the Des Moines Register on May 13th. Cynthia Rye Mitchell, 81, died on May 9th, 2016 at Taylor House Hospice, 2 weeks after being diagnosed with terminal pancreatic cancer. As usual, she was determined to captain her own ship, and this time sunk it with a minimum of fuss. Over the last 29 years, both her ovaries and her heart tried very hard to kill her, but she was having none of it. She was too busy watching her grandchildren be born and grow up, changing jobs in her mid-60s, buying her first house, and stockpiling Kleenex and batteries. She also lived through two subpar husbands, the death of her son, Ned Mitchell, in 1995, and trying to buy paint at Sears. But that devil pancreas finally got her. Cynthia was born in Danville, Illinois, on July 8, 1934. She was a lifelong journalist, first for the Daily Illini newspaper, published by the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, of which she was an alumna. After moving to Des Moines, she spent nearly 30 years as a very exacting and very respected copy editor at the Des Moines Register and Tribune, the first 20 or so of which were fun. After the fun stopped at the Register, she retired from there and moved to Meredith Corporation, where she worked as the copy chief of Traditional Home Magazine for 16 years. Though her plan was to die at her keyboard, she left Meredith shortly before her 80th birthday. Wherever Cynthia was, she was probably the smartest person in the room. She could curse like a sailor and in Croatian, though she almost never did, yet she had exquisite and sophisticated tastes, unstifled by budgetary concerns. She gave generously to many causes and organizations and was literally a card-carrying liberal who put into practice every day the philosophy of live and let live. She was a voracious reader and book collector and loved her beautiful home and garden, especially her front porch, and Jim Gimlet's with plenty of lime, and more than anything, being more mom to her grandchildren. Jennifer Miller wrote that beautiful, smart, funny remembrance of her mother, and she is here with me today. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi, Charity.
I am so sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here to talk today with us. And that obituary that you wrote for your mother caught a lot of people off guard because it is so funny, but also so honest. What went through your mind when you knew it was time to write an obituary?
Well, I don't really know. It's all sort of a blur. It all happened very quickly, as you saw in the obituary. I just sat down. I put it off for a couple of days, and then I just sat down and started writing, and I had one of my daughters at each elbow sort of looking over my shoulder and nixing some things and nodding at others, and I just, you know, I just worked through it, and I revisited it and revisited it until I thought it would do her justice.
Is it something you'd ever talk to your mom about?
Not really.
When you wrote the obituary, did you find yourself thinking what she would think if she could read it?
Oh, absolutely. As it says, she was a very particular sort of copy editor, and I went over it many times, trying to make sure there was nothing amiss. And I also knew that she would not like one of those standard was born, died, parents were, that sort of obituary. She was an unusual person, and I thought she deserved an obituary that captured her personality.
Is this the first obituary that you've ever written?
Actually, I wrote an obituary for my stepfather about 6 years ago. Which was a little less personal because my relationship with him was a little less personal, but I also tried to capture some of his personality.
When you were writing this, did you think about other obituaries that you had read in the past? Were there any that were in your mind that you thought, I want something like that?
No, I am not. As I have found out since this came out, there are people who sort of collect obituaries and read them for, you know, just because they're interested, and I'm not one of those people. So, no, I didn't really have any idea. I just kind of knew what I didn't want to do.
And Have you been surprised? Well, first I should ask you, what kind of a response have you gotten? Of course, it caught our attention, but we're not the only people. When we put up a post on Facebook asking people about the most memorable obituaries, yours for your mother popped up immediately.
Yeah, because I put my email address in the obituary, I got a surprising number of emails from people who I didn't know and my mother didn't know, just, you know, saying they enjoyed it or that, you know, they love a good obituary and they collect them and they, so yeah, there were lots of people who didn't know either of us who I heard from, and it sort of made the rounds around, you know, friends of friends, Facebook, and yeah, I was surprised.
How did you feel about that, having strangers reach out to you?
At first, I felt a little weird, but everybody was so kind and almost to a person. They all said, "She sounds so great. I wish I had known her." And yes, they do wish they had known her, for sure. So I got over that. I mean, it seemed a little weird at first, but like I said, everyone was just so kind about it.
Would your mother have liked that, do you think, people stopping in their tracks to read this and laugh and smile?
I am not sure. That was also maybe gave me a little pause. I am not sure. She was not a person who liked to be the center of attention, and even though she usually was, she didn't crave that. So I don't know, but I think she's okay with it.
Well, when I read this, my first thought was, I wonder if she wrote it herself. Have you had people ask you that?
Yeah, a lot of people. And she might have, but she just didn't have time. I mean, she might have put together an obituary, although I'm not sure if she would have. But she would have written something probably far better. But she just didn't have time.
This happened so quickly, and clearly she lived a very full life. She was 81 years old. But to lose someone with so little warning is so difficult for everyone who has to go through something like that. Do you feel like writing this obituary helped you with the grieving process?
I do. It was nice to sort of be able to encapsulate, you know, however minimally, sort of who she was and what she meant to so many people. Yeah, I mean, it was sudden and it was hard, and that's partly why I agreed to do this. It helps to sort of talk about it, and I love to spread the gospel of Cynthia. And so, yes, it has helped, I would say.
Have you had people asking you for advice now? Because I'm sure a lot of people find themselves writing sort of those boilerplate obituaries for their loved ones who may not have the kind of writing experience that you do or the ability to turn a phrase. Have you had people asking you for advice now?
Well, I've had lots of people saying, "I want you to write mine." but, you know, I don't know that I could do this for anybody else. You know, I grew up basically an only child, so it was just the two of us for most of my life. And so, you know, I had a relationship with her that I don't really have with anybody else.
Does it make you think about what you would like your obituary to say?
Yeah, I'm thinking I need to write mine ahead.
Do your daughters feel like there's a lot of pressure?
I don't know. I haven't asked them. I don't know. Actually, I probably trust. I have three children, and I think among them, they can figure out something that will do me justice.
So, having had a couple of months, and clearly this is a story that's still speaking to people. People are remembering this, and probably will remember it for a long time. How does that make you feel? I know things are still hard and raw right now.
I mean, I think it's great. And if the obituary gave anybody some good ideas about, you know, what they can do with an obituary rather than just sticking to the facts, then I'm glad for that. I think people, everybody's special, and everybody's special to someone. And I think if you can pay homage to their special qualities rather than just what schools they went to and where they worked, I think that's doing our loved ones a service.
Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me.
Jennifer Miller, she wrote a beautiful, smart, hilarious remembrance of her mother, Cynthia Mitchell, who died in May. And this hour, we're talking about the art of writing obituaries. We want to hear from you. What is the most memorable obituary you've ever read or heard? What did it mean to you? You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And with us now is Marguerite Fox. She has written more than 1,000 obituaries as senior writer for the New York Times. You can also read some of her best work in the collection Death Becomes Her, Selected Obituaries by Marguerite Fox. Hello, Marguerite.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And we'll talk a great deal more about how you write obituaries and then the obituaries that are found in the New York Times. But just before we come up on a break here, I'd love to hear your thoughts. What is the purpose of an obituary when it's published in the paper?
Well, it depends on the venue. We heard Jennifer talk very movingly about this wonderful, funny, smart, highly personal obit that she wrote, you know, one of only two obits she was called on to write in her life for someone she knew intimately. My purview and that of my colleagues at the New York Times is necessarily different, where we are writing for a national and these days international audience. And so in our obits, we are of necessity less personal because we are obliged to report the news and write biographies, capsule biographies, of men and women who made the news.
Well, and we will take a short break and we'll get more into how you go about writing those obituaries and what they mean to those who are left behind in just a moment. Marguerite Fox is here with me. She's a senior writer for the New York Times, and she has written many, many obituaries for the New York Times over the years. We also want to hear from you. Tell us about the most memorable obituary you have ever read or heard. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the art of writing obituaries. And with me now, Marguerite Fox. She has written many, many obituaries as a senior writer for the New York Times. We also want to hear from you this hour. Tell us about the most memorable obituary you've ever read or heard, or maybe one that you've written. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Marguerite, of course, everyone deserves to have an obituary. Almost everybody does have an obituary that's published in a local newspaper. And increasingly, there is a life for obituaries online as well. What qualifies someone to have an obituary in the New York Times?
Well, our mandate is necessarily very different, and as my colleagues and I often say to one another ruefully, presiding over the obituary department of the New York Times is something like running the admissions committee for the most highly selective college in the world. Something like 2 million Americans die every year. The New York Times has space in the print paper to run obituaries for only about 1,000 people. So that's less than a tenth of a percent of American deaths wind up as news obituaries in our pages.
Now, I've spent some time reading obituaries in the New York Times, and usually, you know, obviously you write obituaries for famous people, people who lived in the public eye, but occasionally there's an obituary that pops up that is about someone that I guess you wouldn't think of as living in the public eye. Do you try to search out some of these stories that may not be told anywhere else?
We do. There are really two categories of people who receive Times obituaries by and large. And one, as you said, are the presidents and kings and captains of industry. And when people ask me, would you have an advance obituary for me on file? I say, well, if you're the king or queen of something, yeah, rest assured we probably do. But for the rest of us mortals, these judgments have to be made. The other category are what I think of as history's unsung backstage stage players, the men and women who, while not household names, had an idea, did something, invented something, were a witness to history in some way that put a wrinkle in the social fabric. So, for instance, I've done the inventors of the Frisbee, Etch-a-Sketch, Stovetop Stuffing, who was a woman from the Midwest who, God bless her, had the good grace to die right before Thanksgiving, and we were able to run her obit on the Wednesday of Thanksgiving week.
How do you find these people?
All sorts of ways. The internet, of course, makes it easier than ever. We and our editors particularly monitor the Wires, Associated Press, Reuters, the foreign papers, the out-of-town papers, sites like legacy.com, and of course, traditionally, family members and funeral homes have sent in press releases. We used to get many, many faxes a week. Now, of course, they usually come by email. People will telephone us, often very beseechingly saying, can you please, please, please write about my father, aunt, uncle? And we evaluate each one. Again, only a very small percentage make the cut. We're careful to tell families, it's not that we don't think your father was a worthy person. He clearly was. But by our very narrow standards, he was unfortunately not a newsworthy person. That's the crucial difference.
We are going to continue talking about writing those obituaries for the New York Times. Marguerite Fox is senior writer for the New York Times. But we also have a lot of people who want to share their personal stories on the line right now, and you are welcome to join us also. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. Nancy is on the line in Kansas City. Hi, Nancy.
Hi.
Hi, and you are a collector of obituaries.
Yeah, my family, it's weird. My husband thinks it's weird. We all like to read them. We share them when we find a good, kind of unusual mom. We, oh, go look at the paper today. There's a great obituary. So,
well, I think that we'll learn this hour that it's actually not that weird, because I think a lot of people do that, Nancy, and I'm sure Marguerite can tell us that as well. But tell me, being a family that reads obituaries and cares about obituaries, when your mom died, did that make it difficult to write an obituary?
Oh, actually, she and I had talked a lot about, our family had talked with her a lot about it. She had her picture picked out that she wanted. She had, kind of stories that she thought, well, and we actually ended up picking out the various stories, but she was a big storyteller about stories about her life that, you know, weren't like groundbreaking or unusual, but just kind of really encapsulated who she was as a person. So, we just told a story about her. When she died, when she died, a story that nobody kind of outside of our family knew about, her first job coming out of college, teaching at a Catholic school down in Sarasota, Florida, a lot of her students were kids from the circus. And she just loved all of them, and they loved her, and they invited the teachers to the circus, and they learned trapeze and to become trapeze artists. And she, after her first year of teaching, donated her entire salary to allow these kids to go to the Catholic school there. So,
oh, wow.
It was a story that nobody else knew about. We just thought, oh, it's kind of cool that she was a trapeze artist, you know, and that's kind of the exchange they made.
Well, and her incredible generosity, too. Wow.
Exactly. So it was kind of like, you know, your other guest was saying, it wasn't sort of this resume. It was just kind of a lot of stories like that about her. And we got a lot of feedback from people who really enjoyed that. And that would have made my mom extremely happy to know that people kind of enjoyed her obituary. And, gosh, I wish I had known her. And that was the kind of thing we would say when we would run across a really great obituary. Gosh, I wish I'd really known that person.
Absolutely. Well, Nancy, thank you so much for sharing your story with us. And Marguerite, Nancy started out by saying it's weird that her family reads obituaries, but I don't get the sense that that is weird. Why do you think people enjoy reading obituaries so much?
Because they're pure narrative. If you think about it, an obituary is the single most narrative thing in any daily paper. After all, the standard obituary form is obliged, at the very least, to take its subject from cradle to grave. And that gives you a built-in narrative arc. And who doesn't want to read a really good story every day? And what writer, on my end, doesn't love getting paid to tell stories.
Now, writing obituaries as a journalist is not often considered to be sort of the prime goal of someone's career. In some small town papers, I know it's been considered even to be a punishment. What drew you, and it's certainly not that at the New York Times, but what drew you into writing obituaries?
Well, it is true that the child has not been born who comes home from first grade clutching a theme that says, when I grow up, I want to be an obituary writer. This is a career that no one plans for, and indeed, 20, 30 years ago, obit departments on any American newspaper were considered Siberia. It was where they sent you if they wanted to punish you. It was where they sent you if they thought you were a few moments away from needing an obit yourself. Happily, at least in major papers, that has changed, and today obits, for these reasons we've discussed, are one of the most writerly sections on the paper. I began my career on the copy desk of the New York Times Book Review, spent 10 years there, and while it was a great job, I did get a little despondent thinking, well, at the end of the day, the only thing they're going to say in my obituary is she changed 100,000 commas into semicolons. And that wasn't quite enough for me. So I started contributing advance obituaries freelance to the Times obit section because there's always a need. And lo and behold, a job opened up, and because I had a track record, I was lucky enough to get it. So I've been doing obits full-time since 2004.
Well, and that brings up an interesting question that I think a lot of people have. How many obituaries do you write in advance?
There is a popular conception that all obits are written in advance. Would that that were true. Our lives would be so much easier, but it's a Sisyphean task to account for all of the people who might someday become dead, even that small subset of them who are newsworthy. You're still talking about many tens of thousands of people, and our staff is small. So 90% of my job, and that of my colleagues, is to write the daily breaking news obits that are written on deadline in the course of a single caffeine day, like any other news article in the paper. On those rare days when we have some downtime, then we work on advances. And the Times as a whole has probably about 1,700 advance obits in the can. These are for people whose lives are too long, too public, too complex for us to want to get caught short having to write 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 words on deadline.
How is the process different when you, I mean, obviously you get a lot more time, but how does your creative process differ when you write an obituary in advance as opposed to when you're writing one in reaction to loss?
Well, there is very little difference except, as you said, for the level of stress is diminished when we have the luxury of writing in advance. But still, an advance obit, because of the gaping maw that needs to be fed copy, we might have the luxury of 2 days, 3 days for an advance obit, but it's still not a great deal of time. When I talk to academics, if I get a quote from them for a story and they say, so, you know, when do you think you're going to write this? Because they might take 6 months to write a scholarly paper. I say, well, I'll be filing it in the next 2 hours. And they're always kind of stunned, but that's how we have to work. It's a daily paper. And of course, these days, in the age of the internet and the continuous news cycle, we are filing stories not only for tomorrow, but for 5 minutes from now.
Right. We're talking about the art of writing obituaries. You're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. And we'd love to hear about the most memorable obituary you have ever read or heard, or maybe one you've written. Susan is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Susan.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a parish minister, have been for about 30 years, and nearly 20 years ago, I had a funeral for a woman who was 107, and it was a marvelous and celebrative event. And a week or two later, I went to meet with another family to prepare for another funeral, and their 12-year-old son came into the room and introduced himself and talked to me about the funeral for the 107-year-old lady and told me how funny he thought her obituary was. So I thought that was funny that a 12-year-old was reading the obituaries, but he said that he had gotten to the end of her obituary, where you always have the list of who the person is survived by and who preceded them in death. And this 107-year-old woman, it said, was preceded in death by her parents. This has always stuck with me. Of course she was preceded by her parents. So I just wanted to share that. I thought it was a funny piece.
Right. Well, Susan, thank you so much for calling. And I mean, Margalit, there is a formula to even the obituaries that you see in the New York Times. There's a little bit of a formula, although the ones that we read in our local papers tend to be quite formulaic. The ones that aren't are the real standouts. But there are these elements that sort of have to be in every obituary, aren't there?
Yes, absolutely. And again, because these are news articles, we're obliged to answer the proverbial 5 W's, who, what, where, when, and why. And indeed, for obits, there are certain conventions listing survivors, as your caller said. Happily, we of the New York Times in the last 10 to 20 years have begun to play with those conventions. We continue to discharge our obligation to readers by including all that information, but we like to feel that we are doing it more subtly, more artfully, and in a more writerly way. So, for instance, a number of years ago, my editor handed down the very smart dictate that we should no longer end with the survivors. We still give survivors, but we shoehorn them in a little higher up in the story, which leaves us a nice, juicy last paragraph to play with as a writer, where we can end with a quote, we can end with some sort of pithy writerly observation of our own, we can have a real kicker, as it's called in journalism, instead of ending with this leaden thud, he is survived by 15 children and 57 grandchildren. That doesn't make for very good art. So within the constraints of writing nonfiction, writing biography, we are now trying to make art.
Now, of course, a lot of those things that you read in almost every obituary are also placed there because the survivors want them to be there, to say that someone was surrounded by children and grandchildren and those they loved in their final hours. That offers some solace to people as they read that and as they write that. With the New York Times, you don't include a lot of things like that. Is that ever a push and pull with the family?
Well, there are really two categories of families. Again, if we're doing obits of the presidents and kings and old-time Hollywood stars, these are people who have been in public life their whole life. And so the families are very accustomed to dealing with the press, and they have a pretty good sense of what does and does not rate for the content of a news obituary in the New York Times. Families for these unsung players, it might actually be the only time a news article has ever been written about this person. So indeed, you get families in all earnestness saying, please put that he died surrounded by anyone he ever loved. Please put he touched the lives of everyone he ever knew. And we know they mean well, but even apart from the fact that these are just kind of hoary Victorian cliches, things that reflect the interest of the family, however well-intentioned, have no more place in a proper news obituary than things that reflect the will of a government would have in a political story. We can no more let the family control the content of our reporting than a White House correspondent could let the White House control his content.
We have just about a minute before we go to break here. Can you tell me briefly about one of your favorite obits to write?
A recent one was for a man with the wonderful name of Don Featherstone, who was a sculptor in Massachusetts. He worked in plastic and, again, an unsung hero who in the 1950s created the pink plastic lawn flamingo that all of America had on its lawns. And, again, this is a guy you've never heard of who changed the culture.
And his last name was Featherstone, which seems...
It couldn't be more perfect.
No, absolutely. You know, you are constantly surrounded by loss in your work, but it sounds like you thoroughly enjoy finding out about people. Is it emotionally difficult?
Very rarely. Fortunately, we're often asked, oh, you write obits, isn't it depressing? And we say, no, read one of our obits. You'll see in an obit of 900 or 1,000 words, there is maybe a sentence or two about death, which is the obligatory news peg. The other 98% of the obit is about the life. So it may be counterintuitive, it may even be ironic, but obits are remarkably little about death and instead every bit about life.
We're talking about the art of writing obituaries this hour. We're also going to talk about how the digital landscape has changed obituaries and how we remember those we love. With me now, Margalit Fox. She's senior writer for the New York Times and has written many, many obituaries over her long career. And we will continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the art of writing obituaries. We'll also talk about how digital technology and social networks has changed the way we remember people, has changed obituaries, and also the afterlife online. Evan Carroll of the blog The Digital Beyond will be joining us in just a moment. With me right now, Margalit Fox, who's a senior writer for the New York Times and has written many, many obituaries over the years. And I want to get to a couple calls here. Patricia is on the line in Waverly. Hi, Patricia.
Hello. I was calling not so much about the words written, but about the photos that often accompany obituaries. So many times I wish they would be dated because obviously some of these people are sending in ones that are like maybe from their high school, and they're 80 years old. But the one that impressed me the most that I ended up taking a picture of and texting to many of my friends was one that caught my eye in an Iowa newspaper within the last year or so that actually showed a gentleman who is smoking a cigarette and enveloped in a cloud of smoke. And I thought, did he choose that photo or did someone choose that for him?
That is an interesting question. And Margalit, I mean, we've seen pictures change a lot in obituaries. Again, in local papers, often, you know, people will have their sort of church photo session later in life, and that will be the photo. I remember my grandparents telling me that we just had our pictures taken for our obituaries, and I was young enough that that seemed really, really wrong to me. But that was the standard for a long time. Now, with the how technology has changed, how photos have changed, how culture has changed, we see a lot of different kinds of photographs along with obituaries of things changed in the New York Times, too.
Yes, we have a whole wonderful professional picture desk that deals with photos so that we writers don't have to. And indeed, for the famous, of course, we will have file photos of them from throughout their career. So if Katharine Hepburn dies, we'll have photos of her in youth, photos of her in old age, stills from her film, and the picture editors and the page designers can do a wonderful job making up a page and making up a web page that is very visually enticing. For these unsung players, it can be more challenging to get photos because the things that families send in from their family album may not be publication quality. So our picture editors really have to do a lot of detective work. But we try to get the most professional things we can. And indeed, apropos of what your caller says, we try not to have something that's too anachronistic. If we're writing about someone who died at the age of 97, we try to have avoid having a photo of them when they were 20.
Although I'm sure that there are people who probably make that decision before they pass away in local papers and say, hey, this is the picture that I want people to see of me. And I think in the local papers, they certainly have that right. Patricia, thank you so much for your call. And speaking of pictures, of course, a lot of us have created this wealth of information about ourselves online with Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and all of these social media sites. And when we pass away, that information remains online, and it takes on a life of its own in some cases. Evan Carroll is with us. He blogs at The Digital Beyond. He's co-author of Your Digital Afterlife, When Facebook, Flickr, and Twitter Are Your Estate, What is Your Legacy? Hello, Evan.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And give me an idea. I mean, I think a lot of us have experienced this, but of course, every year, hundreds of thousands of Facebook users, for example, will pass away. What happens to someone's profile when they die?
Sure. Facebook is one of the most progressive websites, having a policy and procedure for what happens when you pass away. And what will happen is your profile will become a memorialized profile. And that means your login credentials will no longer work. But everything remains on that page as it was when you passed away, or as of the time you last logged in. And recently, in the last couple of years, they've refined their policies and come up with something called legacy contacts. And that's a way to allow for you to specify someone who can use your Facebook profile after you're gone. So your login won't work. They can't change your past posts. They can't read messages or remove friends. But what they can do is they can create a pinned post on your profile to perhaps share a final message or include information about your memorial. They can respond to new friend requests, and they can update your profile photo and cover photo in case the photo you had up there last was not the approved obituary photo.
Well, and people interact with these Facebook profiles after someone dies. It's become an important gathering place and an important place for people to share stories.
That's absolutely correct. And it was part of the motivation behind Facebook putting in the legacy contact, because families wanted to have a degree of control over these memorial spaces in the same way that they would have control over the obituary in the local papers and control in other situations. They wanted to be able to be a part of that conversation and continue that. And the thing that I find fascinating about these profiles is, one, they are a rich collection of the deceased's life. And so I've been on Facebook for over 10 years now, and that's, I'm 30, I'll go ahead and say that. So a third of my life has been documented by my Facebook profile. And then the ability for that to become a venue where people can remember me, they can talk about me in a very open and natural place for them is quite fascinating.
It's interesting, too. You mentioned the ability to posthumously change somebody's profile picture. You know, when we write obituaries, we tend to write the nicest things about someone and celebrate the best things about their lives. Online, people don't always put their best foot forward. So this is a collection. It may not necessarily be a completely honest collection that reflects a person's life, but it's probably a little more honest than what you would find in an obituary. There can be a downside to that, too. Is that kind of a double-edged sword?
It absolutely is. The authenticity of a social media profile is often far higher than we would find in things that are prepared, and certainly none of the obituaries that are prepared by a professional journalist, but things that were written by a family or, you know, kind of tersely by a funeral home, those articles capture what someone wants them to say. Your social media profiles capture what was said about you by your friends and what you chose to project. And so while there's some authenticity there, there's also a sense of the perspective is that of the deceased and not necessarily the perspective of a professional who's looking upon their life and looking to see what is newsworthy about them.
One of the really interesting things about this sort of afterlife online, I find, is that it, for so many people, you know, the funeral, the obituary, that sort of puts an end to the period of public grieving. But online, people mark the anniversary of someone's death, or on that person's birthday every year, they might write something. And there is this sort of public grieving that continues online.
You're correct. The online profile allows someone to not be constrained by that physical time and place where grieving is appropriate. They can choose to go to that profile on their own time when it makes sense for them. And you're right, some people will continue to post on birthdays. Some will continue to post on someone's wall as if they are still here. They will continue to tag them in photos because they feel like they would have wanted to include this memory as a part of their life. So it's a very real way to continue interacting with someone, because it's exactly how you may have interacted with them online while they were here. And so people take great comfort in that. There's also the flip side where some people don't want to have that constant reminder. And that's why one of the things that Facebook does is they remove the profile from the places where it might show up to reconnect with an old friend or anything that prompts you to remember this person without specifically going to their profile. You won't see that from a memorialized profile. You have to specifically seek them out.
I'm talking with Evan Carroll of the blog The Digital Beyond. Margalit Fox is also here. She's written many obituaries, a senior writer for The New York Times. And Margalit, I am curious, after someone's death, as an obituary writer, you often reach out to the family as part of writing the obituary. Has this kind of wealth of information that is online, has that been something you've been able to use?
With caution, when I teach young journalism students, I have a big PowerPoint slide that says in huge red letters, never trust anything in Wikipedia. From the point of view of someone needing to gather facts on deadline for a news story and making sure they're accurate, the internet is a very double-edged sword. There's great information there, there's bad information there, and it can be difficult to tell at a moment's notice which is which.
Interesting. Well, I do want to give people an opportunity to participate in this conversation. 866-780-9100. And Jim is on the line in Mason City. Hi, Jim.
Tim in Mason City.
Oh, hi, Tim. Tell us a little bit about your story.
Well, my question, I guess, would go to Margalit best. But my mom died of breast cancer back in 1972. And at that time, my father and my older brothers insisted that the cause of death in the obit in the Des Moines Register be listed as emphysema rather than breast cancer, which still sticks in my craw to this day, especially because she never smoked and was years ahead of her time in sending visitors out to the patio if they wanted to have a cigarette and not have it inside. But I'm just wondering if that was a convention back at that time because of the stigma of cancer or what. I've just never understood it. It's never settled in my mind.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for your call. And Margalit?
It is true that until very recently, many illnesses, notably cancer and, of course, in later years, AIDS, were highly stigmatized. And there is a whole generation of people, our parents and grandparents' age, who seem to be born with the knowledge of how to read euphemistic obituary code hardwired into them. And in the old days in obits, long illness always meant cancer, short illness always meant heart attack, and people just knew it. A friend of mine who grew up in the South said in her town, died at home was a euphemism for committed suicide. That's still the very big taboo. And for us, it can be quite a challenge because we do have families still who are skittish about revealing the real cause of death. They try to withhold information. They occasionally try to dissemble. And we are obliged to report the news. So I will occasionally have to tell a family, I cannot knowingly put false information in the paper. First of all, I could lose my job. Second of all, if I feel that a family is asking me to do that, there will be no obit. Now, that's a bluff, but it's a bluff I know they're never going to call because they badly want that obit in the New York Times.
Why is it important to include cause of death?
We're reporting the news. And again, if the whole raison d'etre of an obit, the whole news peg, is obviously the fact that someone dies, it's a gaping hole in information content if you don't say what occasioned that death. We would be very remiss in our obligation to reporting the truth, to reporting history.
It's interesting because it's important in the New York Times to include that. I've noticed in local papers that cause of death is more and more often left out. It's not even in there euphemistically.
Well, local papers have a very different mandate, and each are equally valid. They are serving the community. Where we are writing obits about world leaders and figures large and small who change the world, who really shape the culture, they are writing quite reasonably and necessarily about everyone in town. And everyone's going to know the person about whom they're writing. And so their mandate may be entail being more protective of the deceased and of the deceased's family, who may be well-known members of the community.
Now, when somebody takes their own life, as you mentioned, that's still one of the largest stigmas, something people just don't want shared with the public. How do you deal with that in the New York Times?
It's on a case-by-case basis, and mercifully for all concerned, including the journalists, because those are among the few truly depressing days at work we have when we have to handle a suicide, particularly a young suicide. Mercifully, each of us has to deal with that maybe once a year. I would say 1% of the stories I write over 100 obits a year, maybe one will be a suicide, and there's no Emily Post for this. How do you call up a stranger and say, tell me about how your loved one killed himself or herself, and then I'm going to put what you've told me where a million people can see it? It's a very delicate social situation. A quick example, I had a poet who committed suicide. Interestingly, most of my suicides seem to be poets, which is a whole other sorrowful conversation. And I had heard through channels that he had probably taken his own life. I called his wife, who was herself a poet. I introduced myself, said what I was working on. And then I took a deep, silent breath and said something I would normally never say to a source. I would normally never be this familiar with a source. I said, honey, what the hell happened? And God bless her, she told me.
Wow. Well, and Evan, we have just a couple minutes here. But in the digital world, when someone takes their life or dies unexpectedly, dies young, there seems to me to almost be more importance to this digital afterlife as an online gathering place for people. Have you observed that?
Yes, I have. The younger generations, and unfortunately, suicide tends to be a younger phenomenon. Those individuals, their profiles are even more so that place of remembrance, because they're of the generation where Facebook is a natural language for them, or their social media profiles more generally. That's where they as a generation would convene and would spend time with each other. And so it's very natural for them to spend more time there. And I've even heard of situations where the family is desperate to gain access to a Facebook profile after a suicide, because they want to understand why. They want to understand why their child is no longer with them, and they think that social media might hold the keys to that. And there's a very delicate balance between throwing open the keys versus actually, you know, giving them some privacy.
Right. Well, Evan Carroll, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
Evan Carroll of the blog The Digital Beyond, and Margalit Fox, thank you so much for being here today.
You're very welcome.
Margalit Fox has written more than 1,200 obituaries, a senior writer for the New York Times. You can read some of her best work at Death Becomes Her, Selected Obituaries by Margalit Fox in the collection. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.